I'm John Kroll. Today on No Limits, we're going to talk about guardianship. We're going to talk about what is happening in Indiana to support those who cannot represent themselves. My guests are Kristen Lais. She is the Chief Executive Officer of the Indiana Association of Area Agencies on Aging. Melissa Keys, Legal Director of Indiana Disability Rights. And Rebecca Pryor with Wings Indiana Adult Guardianship. If you want to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or track us down on Twitter at WFYI. Now, this news. Welcome to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We're going to be talking today on No Limits about guardianship. We're going to talk about what's happening here in Indiana in regard to those who cannot represent themselves. If you want to join this important conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI or track us down on Twitter at WFYI. My guests are Kristen Lais. She is CEO of the Indiana Association of Area Agencies on Aging. Melissa Keys, who is the Legal Director of Indiana Disability Rights. And Rebecca Pryor, who is with Wings Indiana Adult Guardianship. Welcome to all of you.
Thank you. Great to be here.
It's good to have you here. So let's start with a baseline, and I'll start with Melissa on this. We ought to talk about what guardianship is so that people understand exactly what we are talking about and what we're going to be talking about.
Sure. Guardianship is where a court has appointed somebody to represent somebody else. So, for example, if it's to the point where you are not able to take care of yourself or your affairs, then the court could appoint somebody to make legal decisions for you. And that's, in essence, what guardianship is.
Okay. And, Kristen, how many people in Indiana fall into this category? Probably ought to say excluding children who are, you know, who have guardians because of their parents and all of that.
Yeah, that's a really good question. Our state doesn't have exact data on that because much of this data is kept locally in the local county court system. Indiana has started a statewide guardian registry system. And in those systems, we've got 60 of our 92 counties participating as of February 2014. And of those 60 counties, 8,800 reported active cases. But that's not complete data across the state. So,
Do we trust the number? I'm sorry to interrupt, but do we trust the numbers out of those 60 counties? I mean, would there be cases that aren't being recorded even there? Did I frame the question inelegantly?
Yes, all counties in Indiana are required to fill out the data sheet that would be used to enter into the system, but not all counties input it into the system. However, that's only on new cases. So even counties that are entering data into the system have not gone back and entered in their old cases. So there are certainly many more thousands of people with guardianship in Indiana that are not recorded in the statewide registry at this point.
Okay. And what is a guardian supposed to do, Rebecca?
A guardian's supposed to stand in the shoes of the person who is determined by the court to not be able to make their own personal decisions for their health care, where they live, who they're going to associate with, and for their financial assets, how their bills get paid, how their monies are managed. Individuals who serve as a guardian have a duty to the court to be honest, straightforward, report to the court the situation regarding the person. I'm a nationally certified guardian. I carry a small caseload. I stand before the court and tell the court as a guardian that I'm going to do my best to make the wishes of the person become reality, or rather, if they cannot express those wishes to me or if they're not realistic for that person, then to use my very best judgment as to how I can do the right thing for that person.
So let me ask, and I'll throw this out to anyone. What are the safeguards in the system? Because I'm sitting here listening to this and thinking, boy, if I were a completely unscrupulous person, I would really, really love to be the guardian of, say, a billionaire with dementia who wasn't really tracking. That would be a system that or a situation one would think that could be easily exploited. I'm going to go with Melissa here just because she made the mistake of making eye contact.
So there is accountability that guardians do have to do. They have to provide an accounting to the court. They have to seek court permission anytime, you know, the person is going to move out of state or something like that. But as far as having regular oversight, the courts do have the power to monitor guardianships and to, you know, provide that oversight. But unfortunately, the resources are not available for courts to have that kind of hands-on, regular oversight. So it's really incumbent on other people in that person's life to be aware of what's going on and what's happening and act as those natural supports to really make sure that that person is being appropriately cared for.
One of the more infamous situations like that is with Ruth Lilly.
Yes.
And you can, I mean, if you take a look at the case, you can see where someone got concerned mm-hmm. about how her funds were being managed and how her life was being cared for. So that's a good example of where someone outside the guardianship took a good look. Unfortunately, you know, you can't just walk up to someone and say, can I see your bank account or, you know, can I see your checkbook, especially if you're talking about financial exploitation. But banks are aware when people are being exploited or funds are moving around that don't look just right. And will often report to Adult Protective Services in Indiana their concerns. And other family members should be at least looking at what's happening to the person.
Kristen.
I think one of the things that's going to help in the future when all the data is being input consistently is the registry. The registry has the ability to interact with the statewide court case management system, which is also coming online. So there'll be communication potentially about filings, about when accountings are due and reports are due and overdue from guardians. And so there is some state data infrastructure going in that when it's all up and running will provide another line of defense and point of monitoring for guardians.
Rebecca, you mentioned that you are a certified guardian.
I am.
What is the process for becoming a certified guardian?
The Center for Guardianship Certification is a national certifying organization, and you must meet the qualifications such as having years of experience working with individuals who have some kind of challenge or incapacity. You have to take certain courses, and you have to pass an exam, and then every 2 years you have to prove that you're keeping up your level of education. And it is not an automatic certification. It's granted based on your abilities as you've proven and based on your criminal history and based on the fact that you wish to serve as a guardian. It's really important for Indiana. The task force, the WINGS Indiana Adult Guardianship State Task Force, is hoping that we will soon take a look at certifying all non-relative guardians in Indiana. That would include all professionals like myself and all attorneys who practice in guardianship.
So let me ask this then. It sounds like that is one avenue to becoming a guardian. Who are the most typical guardians, though? Where do they come from? I'll start with Kristen on that one first, but I saw Melissa leaning in, too.
Well, to my understanding, many of the guardian pool comes from people that the person knows, whether they be a relative or a close friend or somebody in their congregation, a trusted individual that volunteers and steps up. Mm-hmm. These are the folks that we believe require the most support as mm-hmm. guardians, because they're not doing it as a profession. They're not an attorney. They may not have the incentives to be certified. Mm-hmm. Those are the folks that we are working towards as a state coalition of interested people and guardians to provide more support for through education and training.
What are the when you say you want to provide more support, what kind of support are you talking about specifically, Rebecca?
From the task force, we want to provide a resource center for information. Where do you go to get help on decision making or some kind of resource that you need for that person? An online resource center would be our ideal for helping them. We also want to have training for guardians, particularly family guardians or friend guardians, to help them know what they're supposed to do and how to do it. Like anything else, I mean, we go about managing our own lives every day. Mm-hmm. But when you're managing someone else's life, it can be a real challenge. Giving them the kind of resources that makes that job that they have for the court an easier task.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about guardianship on No Limits today. If you want to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at @NoLimitsWFYI or track us down on Twitter @WFYI. So, Melissa, part of me wonders as we're thinking about this, sounds like this is an awful lot of responsibility when you step into it. And I'll admit, I've known a fair number of people who have been in the role of being guardians for someone. Generally, the circumstances are tragic, and I've known at least a couple who found themselves just ensnared in some horrible family politics and all of that. I looked at that and wondered, why would anyone sane want to do this? You know what? What is the motivation for the people who step into these roles?
Well, I think it comes from a place of really wanting to help support somebody. Unfortunately, there's in addition to having guardians who are known, you know, their family or friends, there's also a fair number of people who are quote unquote friendless, who don't have mm-hmm. Somebody readily available that can step in to serve as guardian. And so Indiana has a really interesting program called the VASIA program that has available to it a volunteer advocates that can step in, you know, especially in an emergency type situation where somebody doesn't have a person available to help step in when needed. So that's a program that I do want to make sure that your listeners are made aware of.
And Melissa, real quick, I want to stay with you on that. How many of the folks do we have any idea? Are the numbers as soft or as sketchy on how many people are friendless who don't have guardians or advocates? Is that one of those things where it's like we're trying to prove a negative or?
Right. Yeah. We don't have a whole lot of data on it, but what we do hear anecdotally is that in many instances there are. There is a need, there is a demand for quality guardianship representation for people.
Well, and it would strike me because I'm assuming, are you the only lawyer in the room right now?
Yes.
Okay. All right. So, if they don't have a guardian or an advocate, it's like, the perfect, an endless circle or whatever that they can't get out of because obviously they're not competent to represent or advocate for themselves. Is there any solution to that? How does anyone intervene in that situation?
Well, I think what's important to know is that competency exists on a spectrum, right? Okay. So there's a real breadth. It's not, you know, yes or no where we have competency or not. It's situation specific. It's task specific. It can be dependent on whether somebody is currently going through symptomatology. So when we talk about capacity building, there's always opportunities to build in self-determination and self-empowerment to be able to practice and really make decisions. And one of the concepts that's somewhat new, bring that to the forefront is supported decision making.
We have a lot to talk about. We're talking about guardianship today on No Limits. My guests are Kristen LaEast, CEO of the Indiana Association of Area Agencies on Aging, Melissa Keys, Legal Director of the Indiana Disabilities Rights, and Rebecca Pryor with Wings Indiana Adult Guardianship. I'm John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please, stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, Director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking today about guardianship on No Limits, about what's happening in Indiana to support people who cannot, for whatever reason, represent themselves. If you want to join this conversation, you can call us at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, or you can track us down on Twitter at WFYI. My guests are Kristen LaEast. She is the CEO of the Indiana Association of Area Agencies on Aging, Melissa Keys, Legal Director of Indiana Disability Rights, and Rebecca Pryor, who is with Wings Indiana Adult Guardianship. So before we went to the break, we were talking about the people, for lack of a better term, who are friendless. And we learned that, like the numbers regarding guardianship itself, the data are incomplete on people in those situations, in part because obviously if they don't have a guardian, they probably don't have someone to speak for them. Or advocate for them at that point. So we probably ought to talk about how people go about either finding or securing guardians. I'll start with Kristen on that one.
So fortunately in our state, there are different kinds of service systems that are able to make referrals to guardianship services. So one of those is the system I represent of Area Agencies on Aging and Disability. We serve older adults and people with disabilities of any age. So pretty much anybody can call us with a guardianship concern and talk through those concerns, and we can connect them with the services that are available in their area. Other folks may find the guardianship services because perhaps somebody has called Adult Protective Services with concerns about an individual, and APS makes that referral. Or they may show up at a local hospital system, and upon discharge, there's a realization that person really probably needs some extra advocacy support, and they may be referred to guardianship. The Indiana Supreme Court has an Office of Adult Guardianship, and that's easy to find if you Google it, and they can certainly connect people with the volunteer advocates program that Melissa talked about earlier. So there are multiple ways to refer into the system. It's kind of finding that door. And once you find that door, those services, that connection can be made to those services.
What are the standards for saying that someone needs a guardian at that point? I'll go with Rebecca, but I also want to hear Melissa's views on that too. Rebecca, you can get us started though.
In Indiana, most courts require that an Indiana licensed physician determine that the person has some type of incapacity and actually affirm that to the court. When an individual is petitioning to have guardianship established for perhaps their loved one or their friend. And it's a very important aspect of it because incapacity is considered under the statute to be your ability to manage your life, and your physician is probably the most knowledgeable person out there who is able to say that about their patient.
Melissa.
And I would echo what Becky said. It's basically whether or not somebody is able to take care of themselves, whether they have the ability to make decisions, whether they can handle their finances, whether they can, you know, understand the medical decisions that need to be made. And again, what I would really, you know, want to stress is that capacity is not tied to a specific diagnosis. It's not, you know, as soon as you get a diagnosis of Alzheimer's or if you have a diagnosis of Down syndrome, that doesn't automatically mean that you need a guardian. It's very specific, and it can, you know, like I had mentioned before, it can fluctuate and it can ebb and flow as somebody's skills increase or decrease as, you know, as symptoms, you know, come around. So the important thing to understand is that if a court finds that the person lacks capacity, then that's the standard. And that's usually supported with, like Becky said, with a physician statement.
Is this something that, though, that and I'll throw this one to Kristen first, because of the nature of her organization, its responsibilities, that people themselves ought to kind of plan for. I mean, if you look at the numbers, if you live long enough, you know, the chances that you are going to experience dementia increase dramatically. I mean, and assuming that you will be immune from those statistics is probably a little foolish, that there's not a chance that this could afflict you. In that case, are there steps that individuals can make to say, you know, in the event that I am incapacitated, this is who I would like to have serve as my guardian? I'll start with Kristen on that one. And is it prudent to start thinking about that? And when is it prudent to start thinking about it?
As soon as you're an adult and not making decisions for your parents aren't making decisions for you, that's when it's prudent to start thinking about, because adults of any age can become incapacitated. Certainly, we think of older adults and dementia and frailty and decline as an indicator that maybe we need to look at capacity issues, but it's relevant for people of any age. And the state does promote what we call advanced care planning. And guardianship is kind of one of those pieces on that continuum where you start out by looking at advanced directives for your health care or appointing a health care representative. Maybe you want to appoint a power of attorney. You know, a little further down the road, you might need a representative payee to help you with your finances, et cetera. So there's a continuum of tools that you can start looking at as soon as you're an adult and able to start planning out some of those decisions. And those the tools that you use may change or that you need may change as your condition changes over the years, as you age from a young adult to an older adult and need to start thinking even harder about some of those questions about if I need a guardian, who should that be? If I want a power of attorney, if I, you know, what are the appropriate tools for me to use so that I can be supported in the decisions I need to make?
Melissa, are there points, though, when you need to revisit that? Because some of what we're talking about here, like if you are part of a married couple or whatever, I think the presumption is obviously that the spouses will sort of assume those roles, but, you know, say the marriage ends or you become widowed or whatever, do you need to revisit those considerations at that point?
Well, I think it's prudent as part of any life care planning, just as you would update your will every time you have a child or, you know, you would update your beneficiary for life insurance. It's you know, prudent to take a look at it. But I wanted to touch on something that Kristen mentioned that about the spectrum of services available, because I think that's really key. Is it's not just guardianship or not guardianship. There's a whole host of tools that are available for people that range, you know, from completely, you know, using, things like natural supports to help make decisions all the way up to a full guardianship, full plenary guardianship. And there's many, many steps in between. And the goal is to try and find the least restrictive option available to allow the person to have the most independence possible while still being able to help them in whatever ways that they need to have that support.
When you say natural supports, what do you mean by that?
Just how you know, every day, the human experience of how we make decisions. I mean, we don't make decisions in a vacuum. We consult with our friends. We talk to experts. We use all that information to make an informed decision. And natural supports are kind of that informal way that we do that.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about guardianship here on No Limits. If you want to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org, find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, or track us down on Twitter at wfyi. So, Rebecca, I'm going to ask this question. If, you know, in some of these situations, I think it was Kristen who was saying, you know, there are these moments when you notice that a loved one might be in need of some help or support, or, you know, may need guardianship. What are some of the signs that, you know, family members or, you know, close friends, people who care about someone should be looking for to say, oh, okay, this person probably does need a guardian, or, as you know, as Melissa was saying, needs some sort of intercession here along that spectrum of support. What are some of the signs and signals that people ought to be looking for with their loved ones?
I think the one people usually start to rely on and look at is memory, is remembering what day it is in the week, what you did yesterday, who a person is. It's also not doing the things that you regularly do, and there's no illness or medical reason that you wouldn't be doing those things. Say that, you know, you go out every Wednesday to the grocery store, and then as you're talking to the person and you find that they haven't been out to the grocery store for 4 weeks, I mean, they're not keeping their daily thinking routine going on. Certainly if their medical health begins to fail, they have heart disease that's incapacitating, or they have some kind of illness that puts them in a situation. And then, you know, it's just that feeling you get that they're not really on top of everything. They're not paying their bills. And you see when you go to visit them, especially if you're their adult child, piles of unpaid bills sitting on the desk that where mom used to write the checks every week and send them out, and now she doesn't. And I think, you know, just those simple signs call you to reach out to their physician to say, have you seen her recently? Maybe working to get them in to see their physician so that there can be a good assessment. You can also, I mean, at times it's sometimes difficult, but you can sit down and talk to them about how they're feeling and what they're doing every day.
And Kristen, can we, because I'm sure there are people out here who are listening to this program right now and are thinking, oh, you know, I know someone who's in that situation, maybe my mother or my father or whatever. And I cannot imagine that those are easy conversations to have. Let me put it this way. I would feel tremendous sympathy for my own children for the moment when one of them comes to me and says, Dad, I don't think you can take care of yourself anymore. I need to move into that role for you. How do you structure a conversation like that? How do you go about doing it so that you make the point, but you do it in a way that that is, you know, the least hurtful?
Well, fortunately, there are lots of resources available on how to have those conversations. One of the things people can do for free is contact their area agency on aging and disability.
Go ahead and give them the contact info then. It doesn't help them in the abstract,
right,
so go ahead and
right.
let them know how to do that.
You can find your area agency through our website. It's IAAAA.org or 800-986-3505. And so that's one way of locating your area agency on aging. You call and you say, this is the situation I'm facing in my family, and there are lots of resources the area agency can provide related to helping support a caregiver when you're getting ready to move into that role, or you need to have difficult conversations about decision-making, about whether what kinds of supports that person needs as they are, and what tool is appropriate to support those decisions that need to be made. So people don't have to worry about remembering what's on this conversation today on the radio or worry about finding it for themselves on the web. These services are available all across our state through the local area agency on aging.
And if you wouldn't mind, in addition to obviously just giving it over the air, after we go off the air, if you wouldn't mind visiting our Facebook page and putting the contact information in there.
Sure.
Too. We drive a lot of our listeners continue the conversation on Facebook after we go off the air. So, Melissa, walk me through the process here. One, let's say you have a conversation with a parent or a loved one and say, these are my concerns, the kinds of conversations we just talked about. And mom or dad says, you know, you're right, I probably do need this kind of help at that point. What are the steps then to put a guardianship in place, the legal steps for doing that? And then the second question, so you can have some time to think about that one, is going to be, what are the steps if mom or dad says, no, I don't think so, and you're convinced that you're right and someone does have, you know, they're not able to take care of themselves at that point.
Well, it sounds like a bar exam question, so I'll do my best. But So when you talk about the legal steps, one of the things that you wanted to, that you would want to first do is when you're talking to the family and you're talking to the person who is the subject of the potential guardianship, is to really drill down to what supports is it that they need, because it's possible that through different ideas of whether, you know, maybe having a joint bank account or setting up online bill pay to help with some of those day-to-day things, or having, you know, medication reminders sent to their phone. There's lots of different ways that you can help structure to support somebody that doesn't automatically jump to guardianship, which is basically the most restrictive thing that you can do. So with the idea of trying to keep, you know, dignity and independence as robust as possible, really trying to drill down to what is it that we can do with the resources that we have to really support the person. If guardianship is the only option available, meaning that nothing less restrictive is available, then there is, you know, a way to file a petition for guardianship, gather all the appropriate documentation. The court will, should appoint what's called a guardian ad litem, who would provide the best recommendation to the court as to whether or not the person is incapacitated and the appropriateness of the person who has petitioned to serve as guardian. The court ultimately would make a decision as to both of those prongs, and then that's kind of how it would go. Now, if mom or dad objects and they don't want to have a guardianship placed over them, unfortunately, in Indiana, there is no right to counsel like you would think about in a criminal proceeding. So even though guardianship is essentially, you know, terminating somebody's civil rights, it's putting decision-making mm-hmm. power into somebody else, there really isn't a good mechanism to make sure that person's interests are represented. I mentioned the guardian ad litem, and that person, while oftentimes they may be supportive of the person who is the subject of the petition, they may not necessarily be the ones. They may not necessarily follow what the person's wishes are. They are required to do what's called the best interest standard. So really, it would be if somebody does not want a guardianship placed over them, they could call, you know, an organization like mine, Indiana Disability Rights, for help.
We're talking about guardianships here on No Limits today. My guests are Kristen Lais of Indiana Association of Area Agencies on Aging, Melissa Keys of Indiana Disability Rights, and Rebecca Pryor with Wings Indiana Adult Guardianship. I'm John Kroll. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking about guardianship today, about what's happening in Indiana to support people who cannot represent themselves. If you want to join this conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You also can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, or you can track us down on Twitter at WFYI. My guests are Kristen Lais. She is CEO of the Indiana Association of Area Agencies on Aging, Melissa Keys, who is the legal director of Indiana Disability Rights, and Rebecca Pryor, who is with Wings Indiana Adult Guardianship. So it's a question we've sort of circled around, but I'm gathering from some of the comments that we've made that there are probably not enough guardians, or at least qualified guardians, to go around. Kristen was the one nodding her head most emphatically on that one. So I'm going to start with her on that. First, let's confirm that there aren't enough to go around. Are there particular areas where there are shortages, or particular kinds of guardians where we don't have enough of them? Kristen.
Well, generally, I can confirm that our state does not have enough guardians for the people who need them. There are referrals at various points made for guardianship services that may have to wait because no one is available to advocate for that person. We have been able, through the VASIA program that we've talked about, expand the number of guardians statewide. The VASIA program is administered by the Indiana Adult Guardianship Office at the Supreme Court, and they work with local service agencies who administer the program locally, and those local service agencies are able to recruit local guardians. So part of the issue is just having that infrastructure to support those volunteers, which is what we're trying to expand across the state. And currently, we have 42 counties in Indiana that are participating in the VASIA program, and 630 clients and about 260 active volunteers. So that's one way we are trying to meet the need of different kinds of guardians, and maybe I'll let Becky talk about particular types of guardians and the if there are specializations that people need to think about.
Mm-hmm. Rebecca.
I'd like to give a plug for the VASIA program also. It's Volunteer Advocates for Seniors and Incapacitated Adults. It's modeled on the very popular court-appointed special advocate program for children who are abused and neglected. It's an opportunity to serve as a volunteer advocate with a agency or organization behind you to support you, to assist you in making decisions for a person. Indiana embraces volunteerism at a very high level. So this is a way in your own community you can do something about the thousands of people who are actually in need of a guardian. Kinds of guardians we have in Indiana, we have a very limited number of certified guardians in Indiana because we don't require certification. So that's less than 50 in Indiana. It's a very poor showing, okay, for the numbers of certified guardians. We have agencies that serve as guardians. Some of the area agencies on aging actually have guardianship programs. There are some nonprofits other than the aging who serve as a guardian or who can. We have a variety of ways in which people can serve. You can be an individual or a corporation and serve as a guardian in Indiana. It is just a real clear fact, I think, that there aren't enough guardians, because I get those calls every week in my office. I'm a solo practicing guardian. Mm-hmm. People call me and ask, will I serve? I got one this morning. Mm-hmm. Will I serve as a guardian for this person who's in a nursing home? And also I get the calls for the individuals who are intellectual or developmental disability cases where, you know, they need someone to participate in their decision-making team. So there are just a lot of different aspects about the guardianship that where people can get involved or serve.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about guardianship on No Limits today. And if you want to join the conversation, you can call us at 866-476-3881. You can find us on Facebook at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can track us down on Twitter at WFYI, or you can do what a listener named Pat has done and send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Pat's email speaks to sort of the complexity of these issues. She writes, I'm assuming it's a she, and I probably shouldn't have, says, thanks for covering the topic. On the description of what a legal guardian is, the discussion so far seems to blur the different types. A guardian ad litem represents a person's interests at court. A guardian of the estate represents the financial interest of the ward. A guardian of the person represents the health and other aspects. A guardian may override the decisions of the individual in contrast with the power of attorney that may represent the individual, but the individual may choose to do something different. I learned these distinctions while serving as co-guardian for my schizophrenic uncle. He was previously a ward of his sister in New York when she died. We were not prepared, and after a couple of years, we arranged our uncle's release to our care. We had retained attorneys in both New York and Indiana to arrange the transfer. We would have preferred to only have power of attorney, but to ensure New York would release our uncle to us, our attorney advised to request full guardianship. Because of the differences in allowed resources for Medicaid, our uncle had sufficient funds to require we be both guardian of person and guardian of person and estate. Once his funds were below the Medicaid limits, the guardian of estate was dropped with the help of the attorney we used for the guardianship. At our uncle's death, we arranged for the funeral and discovered afterwards that our rights as guardians were gone as of his death. Forgive me, Melissa, but that sounds just incredibly complicated. And Pat, I sympathize and admire your willingness to step into that role and take care of your uncle. Probably goes without saying, if you're going to do this, you probably ought to have an attorney's advice and counsel.
Right. You don't necessarily have to have an attorney, but it is recommended because they can get fairly complex, especially if you're dealing with somebody who may have a chronic illness, who may have, you know, really high medical bills, or, you know, somebody who also needs additional Medicaid planning or service planning or things like that. And she is absolutely right that there's different types of guardianship. There's even within that, there's temporary guardianships that can be done in an emergency situation that automatically lapse based on, you know, whatever is written in the court order. There are full guardianships that are over both the person and the estate, and there are partial guardianships that cover, you know, one or the other. And there are differences, and I applaud her for considering that. She felt that they only needed the power of attorney. And oftentimes, once you're under guardianship, it becomes exceedingly difficult to get out from under that guardianship. That's why it's very important at the outset to make sure that before you put this extreme measure in place, that you've looked at all the options that are available.
So let me ask the last point Pat makes here. saying we'd learned that our rights as guardians had terminated upon death. What does that mean?
So the guardianship ends as soon as the incapacitated person passes. And there are a few things that guardians can do to wrap up kind of immediate things. But in essence, the guardianship terminates when the person is no longer alive.
So what is the practical effect of that? I mean, I'm thinking the legal reasoning for this would be that, you know, obviously if the person's no longer alive, he or she no longer needs, you know, care. Mm-hmm. But it sounds like what you're saying is it can also make it difficult to wrap up an estate.
Yes, yes. And oftentimes the guardians would then have to, you know, open a if the person doesn't have a will that names, you know, who they want to have as their personal representative for any estate work, trying to unravel and get all of that stuff taken care of can be challenging. And that's why it's a good practice to get the involvement of an attorney.
Rebecca, looks like you wanted to say something.
Right. This is also an issue that the WINGS Guardianship Task Force has taken up. It's a concern. It's a concern for me as a practicing guardian. I've been fortunate to have judges who've continued my guardianship for the purpose of cleaning up everything that needed to be done, including burying my client. Mm. I've had to ask the court's permission to do that. And that is one way you can make it work. Mm-hmm. But what we're looking at in the task force is that should be statutory, and I shouldn't have to go back to the court every time, but that guardians, in fact, should be able to finish their job. If there's a will and another person who takes over, then that's a different circumstance. But if there's no one, and often there has not been anyone, and there isn't anyone at the end, the guardian should be allowed to complete their task, and especially, again, assuring that the person is buried with dignity.
I've gotten another email, this one from a listener named Adam. And again, if you want to join the conversation via email, you can find us at nolimits@wfyi.org. Adam's got a short question. Are there any alternatives to guardianships in Indiana? Kristen, I'm going to throw that one to you because it sounds like it's talking about the spectrum you were referencing.
Correct. This idea of supporting people in decision-making and helping people take care of themselves range from very unrestrictive options to the most restrictive, which is the full guardianship of the person and the estate. So when you look at options, some of the things we've mentioned during our conversation today are supported decision-making, which is a contract as opposed to a guardianship, about who can help this person make decisions. They include basic advanced care planning tools like the power of attorney, like filling out the advanced care directives and naming a healthcare representative. If you need help with your affairs in a formal way, there are agencies and people that can step up and just help you manage your financial affairs. So there is that range. And for example, organizations like Indiana Disability Rights or Area Agencies on Aging or other kinds of advocacy organizations that regularly work with persons in need of making these kinds of decisions, you can contact them and talk through a lot of those different kinds of options.
Are there enough points on the spectrum here, or does Indiana law need to be more nuanced to deal? Melissa's smiling at me, so I'm assuming Melissa wants that one.
Well,
she's leaning in like I just threw a fat softball right down the middle of the plate.
We have an exciting program going on right now in Indiana through the WINGS program in the Office of Adult Guardianship that is specifically looking at supported decision making, which is a national trend that we're hoping to bring to Indiana. And what that involves is a less restrictive alternative to guardianship. And it involves the person selecting a team of people that they are going to go to help them make some of life's tough choices. The key difference is that instead of a guardian making decision or instead of an agency representative making a decision on behalf of the person retains the right to make the decision themselves, and they are empowered to do so and have their decision respected. That's an exciting program. We are really excited to have that here in Indiana, and we look forward to trying to expand it statewide, because right now we are just focused on the pilot project in Wayne County, but we are hoping to expand it farther.
So I want to get to this question really of let's assume that there are people who are listening to this and have heard there's a shortage of you know, guardians out there. There are people in need. This might be a way I could make a contribution where I can help somebody. What sort of qualities, make for a good guardian, and so that people will think, okay, well, yeah, maybe I fit that description as well. This is something I ought to do. I'll start with Kristen on that one. Are you throwing? She's looking over.
I'm eyeing Becky because it gets to some of the standards, for example, and characteristics that as a certified guardian, I think she would have a really good answer about that.
Okay, Rebecca, you've been queued up. I think
a person needs to be 21 at least, the age of majority, in terms of. Being an adult, or at least that's where we consider them to be when we're talking about guardians. A person who's reasonable, has proved that they have good decision-making powers, has a clear criminal record, who has a good work history, and who genuinely cares about individuals in their community. There isn't any education component that we require, just that the person cares enough to become educated about how to be a guardian.
We're getting a little bit close on time, and we just got a good question via Facebook. And again, if you want to send us a question via Facebook, you can find us at No Limits WFYI. This comes from a listener named Shannon who says, how long does the process of establishing guardianship typically take? Melissa, from the roll of the eyes, I'm thinking it could be anybody's guess, right?
It really depends on the circumstances. There are some guardianships where the question of capacity is very clear, and it may be the parents who are petitioning to have guardianship over their child, and once their child turns 18, and so it's a little bit clearer path. There are ones that are very complicated. You mentioned earlier about family dynamics, mm-hmm. and family fighting. So it really depends on the circumstances.
So let me ask this again, going back to this question of somebody who's out there and thinks I might be a good guardian. Now that we've established what the criteria are, how do you go about doing that? What's the first step, Rebecca?
Well, if there's a VASIA program in your community, and you can find out about that by contacting your local probate court or the court that handles the guardianships, and they can tell you where to go. You can go to the website at the Supreme Court for the Adult Guardianship Office and find all the VASIA programs that are in the state, and hopefully you'll have one in your community. You could also step up and help us start those in the ones where we don't yet have an established guardianship. I suppose that I've not been in the circumstance, but I suppose that if you really wish to serve as a guardian, you could notify your local court that you might be available to serve when the judge has a dilemma and wishes to appoint someone outside the family situation.
And we've got just a few seconds here, but how long, if you do want to do this, how long does it typically take to become a guardian?
In terms of the process in the court, it could be within 24 hours in an emergency temporary.
I want to thank my guests, Kristen Lais, Melissa Keys, and Rebecca Pryor for a fascinating conversation today on No Limits. Invite all our listeners to come back next Tuesday when we're going to talk about the big dig. I am John Krall. You've been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Producers Sarah Neal Estes, Roxana Caldwell, and Jill Sheridan. Interactive Media Coordinator Scott McAllister. Technical producers Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood, and board engineer Joe Hatcher. Emily Matheny screens our calls. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.